All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's February 8th. And let's see. Let's look at the schedule a little bit. You have a test coming up, test one, exam number one, on February 17th. That's a week from Wednesday. It's not this Monday, it's a week. And it's kind of delayed because we got still practicums going on this week. So you still, some of you still might have some practicums. So we would have it on Monday of next week, a week from today. But guess what is a week from today? It's a holiday, so we can't have a test. All right, so it's going to be on Wednesday of next week. All right, so that will allow me to catch up. Maybe you guys too. But if you're catching up on Monday and your test is Wednesday, guess what? It's too late. So make sure you start studying already, okay? And for sure this week sometime. All right, you see on the screen that we were talking about integument last time. And what are the two, let's just kind of review in our mind. What are the two main regions of the integument? Okay, the skin is the integument, sure. And so, okay, different ways we can classify it. You can think of integument as being made up of skin and accessory structures, which is what you're saying, hair, and there's some glands and nails, right, and a little muscle in there as well. Okay, but we can also analyze the integument and break it down into two main layers. That's what I mean. Okay, the two main layers. Epidermis. What kind of tissue is the epidermis? It's a stratified squamous epithelium, okay? And then what's the deeper layer called? That's the dermis, right? And there's another layer that we just kind of throw in this chapter. It's not really part of the integument, but since it's right there, we talk about it right now. That's the hypodermis. So epi means on top, hypo means below. Okay, so now you got to know the layers within the two major layers. And so let's talk about the dermis. What are the two main layers of the dermis? And I think we got this far last time. Okay, the superficial part of the dermis is called the papillary layer. And then there's a deep layer that's called the reticular layer. Reticular layer is real strong and tough because it's loaded with what kind of chemical? Collagen. Collagen is in the dermis, right? And where do you find that collagen? Is it intracellular or extracellular? It is extracellular because the dermis is what kind of tissue? And that reticular tissue is what kind of tissue? It's a connective tissue. So where do compounds go? What makes that connective tissue, or what gives connective tissue its particular characteristics? It's the matrix, which is all the junk outside the cell, right? So that collagen is extracellular. That's a lot different than the epidermis. Okay, so let's see, the epidermis, there's a couple different kinds, right? You got thick skin and thin skin. In thin skin, you should know the layers. Let's start with the deepest layer. What's that? Stratum basale, then stratum spinosum, stratum granulosum, and stratum corneum, right? And in thick skin, there's one additional layer, the stratum lucidum. And where would you put that additional layer? Right on the top? No, it goes right underneath a stratum corneum. So it's between the granulosum and the corneum. So try to get some kind of picture in your mind of that. You know, if you're not really good at just memorizing layers, try to get a picture in your mind, and I think that will help you out a lot. So even if you have to draw it, that's a really good thing for you to do, right? Of course, you can label the figures that are in the exam study guides, and it will help you a lot. And as a matter of fact, on the exam coming up, you all should get 100% on labeling those exam figures. Now, it seems like a big effort, but you can just clean that part of the test. 100%, that's really fantastic, right? So that will give you a lot of breathing room on other aspects of the test. All right, so the slide we see right here shows the layers except for the stratum lucidum, right? So here we see mitosis taking place in the stratum basale, right? And then the cells move up into the stratum spinosum, and they start to change. A chemical begins to build up inside these cells. All right, remember, epithelium doesn't have much extracellular space. So this chemical is building up intracellularly. So, and tell me the name of that chemical. That's keratin. Keratin gives these cells strength. right? And then they move up to the stratum granulosum, and they die as they move up to the stratum corneum. Why do they die as they move away from the stratum basale here? Because there's no blood vessels, right? They're moving farther and farther away from blood vessels, so they run out of oxygen and nutrients, right? Okay, so that's a pretty good review of what we talked about last time. I think I do want to go back and take a look at this picture right here. Okay, because there are some structures that we haven't really gone over yet. This is a really nice illustration. Let me zoom in, I think. That might help a little bit. And what do you think about the lights? Should I turn the lights down some more, or is that good enough? Good enough? Okay. All right, so here you can see the two main layers, namely the epidermis from the stratum basale up to the stratum corneum. I'm not sure you can see all the sublayers of the epidermis right here, okay, but at least you can see the stratum basale and the stratum corneum, and you know the layers in between. And then underneath the epidermis is the dermis from here to down over here. It contains blood vessels. So this is a highly metabolic region right here where we have muscles and nerves and glands, okay? And these blood vessels also nourish the stratum basale. We can see some a papillary plexus right here where capillaries are feeding or giving nutrients to the stratum basale. So this layer right here, because of that is highly vascular and is loose areolar connective tissue, we call this the papillary layer because of all these papillae that we find in this layer. And then the deep layer is loaded with collagen, and that was named long time ago called the reticular layer. Even though it doesn't have much in the way of reticular fibers, it has collagen that gives it strength. All right, so we see some other structures. We see some glands with tubes. What kind of gland has a tube or a duct? Can you remember two general kinds of glands? We've got exocrine and endocrine. So when you see a gland with a tube right here, which one of those two is it? It's an exocrine gland. So if there's a duct with a tube, it's an exocrine gland. This gland secretes a product, and it goes into this tube, and the tube carries that product to where it should go, namely the surface of the skin. All right, so this is a typical kind of sweat gland. We call that an eccrine sweat gland. It produces a water and salty solution, and basically that's used to cool your body down when you start to get hot, because that water evaporates off your skin, and that takes a lot of energy, and in the terms of heat, it reduces the temperature of your body. Okay, I see another kind of gland, and it is always going to be associated with a hair follicle right here. And this is also an exocrine gland. I don't see a duct, but it secretes its product into the hair follicle, and then it uses that as a duct to get to the surface of the skin, and it also lubricates the shaft, right, of the hair follicle as well. This is what we call a sebaceous gland. It doesn't secrete a water and salty solution, but more of an oily solution. So that improves the permeability barrier of the skin. It also acts like a little bacteriostatic agent, so only the right kinds of bacteria grow on the surface of your skin and not pathogenic bacteria. Okay, and so here I can see another hair follicle. And what's associated with this hair follicle? What kind of gland is that? That's always going to be a sebaceous gland, right? So you see hair follicles with glands, that's a sebaceous gland. There's another kind of gland that you've seen in lab, in the model in lab, and that is an apocrine gland. And it's not on this particular illustration right here, but it's about twice the size of an eccrine sweat gland, and it's found in the axillary region and inguinal region, and it doesn't secrete a water and salty solution. Again, it's more of an organic secretion. And bacteria can use that as an energy source, and that's why some parts of our body are more odoriferous than others, because bacteria can use that oily secretion, all right, for their own purposes. And it's the bacteria that have a little bit of an odor, not the secretion itself. Okay, so that's pretty much it for glands. And your skin is very important for communication. So you have receptors that can sense things in the environment. Okay, so what things can you sense with the surface of your skin? Pressure. Okay, let's talk about some pressure receptors. Right here we have a Meissner's corpuscle. Notice how close to the surface it is. So Meissner's corpuscle is sensitive to light pressure. It's very good for fine discrimination. All right. There are some deeper receptors. And in the model in lab, you see this way down in the dermis, maybe even in the hypodermis. This is what we call a Pacinian corpuscle. So these are good for deep pressure. All right. So Pacinian corpuscle is down over here. We have other receptors. Here we have some free nerve endings, and you can see this one wrapping itself around a hair follicle. So that means when something brushes up against a hair, a part of a hair above the surface of the skin is called the shaft. So if something brushes up against this hair follicle right here, right, these are the fibers, the nerve fibers that pick up that sense of touch. That's very, very sensitive. All right, and in particular, some regions of your body are going to be super sensitive. So what hairs on your body are super sensitive? As soon as they're brushed, it's going to trigger a reflex. You just did it, but nothing touched your hairs that I'm thinking about, namely your eyebrows and your eyelashes, right? Because they're there to sense objects that are approaching your eye. So as soon as those hairs get stimulated, okay, you're going to blink and protect your eyes. And it's due to these free nerve endings down over here. All right, there are other free nerve endings we can see in different places, like right here. All right, so these can also sense pain, but they're also important for temperature. So pain nerves are free nerve endings, and temperature nerves are free nerve endings as well, for both hot and for cold. They're different kinds of nerves for hot and cold. Okay, so those are all important things. Now, where do you have that sense of cold in your integument? Is it all over your body or just in a certain location? If I take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, can you feel it? If I put it on your kneecap, can you feel it? Put it on your belly button, can you feel it? Yeah, you have temperature receptors all over your body, right? Okay, so because of that, we call a temperature sensation a general sense because you find them all over your body. All right, we got another important thing right here. This is the erector pili muscle. And you can see that it attaches itself to a superficial layer in the dermis. And the other end goes actually part to an epidermis down over here that's associated with a hair follicle. All right, so you might be a little bit confused because I said this is dermis here, but this is epidermis way down here. Why is that? Why did I say that? Oh, somebody's kind of motioning with their hand. Well, notice the stratum basale, that it's not just a flat line. It does what? It kind of curls around all over the place, and if you follow it to a hair follicle, what happens? It surrounds the sebaceous gland and it goes all the way deep down into the dermis right here, right? So you do have epidermis really, really deep in the dermis. And this is a really important example I use to discuss how important it is to know layers, all right, in people from a clinical standpoint. All right, but nonetheless, when this erector pili contracts due to these motor fibers right here, all right, can you tell me, is that a smooth muscle, a cardiac muscle, or skeletal muscle? What can you tell me about that muscle right there? Okay. What is a characteristic of skeletal muscle? Is it voluntary or involuntary? Voluntary. It's voluntary. What about smooth muscle? Voluntary or involuntary? Involuntary. Well, I hope nobody thinks that that's cardiac muscle, because where do you find cardiac muscle? In the heart only. So that's not cardiac muscle. So your choice basically is smooth or skeletal muscle. Okay. Now think. Can you cause your hairs on your arms to stand up on end? Because that's what's going to happen when this muscle contracts. It's going to pull the hair follicle up, causing a little bump right here. Right? We call that a goose pimple or a goose bump. Can you voluntarily get that muscle to contract, giving you goosebumps just like contracting a biceps? You cannot. So now you can answer that question. Is that skeletal or smooth muscle? That's got to be smooth muscle, because you really don't have control over that muscle with your conscious thought. Unless you play a little trick in your mind or something, like scare yourself doing some kind of meditation or something, or think you're freezing, maybe you could get those hair follicles to stand on end. But basically, oh, another good example is, you have a nerve going to this one hair follicle, you can't cause a goosebump on that one hair follicle out of the thousands that you have on your body, right? unlike skeletal muscle that you can contract one muscle anywhere in your body. Okay, so that's another good example. All right, let's get back to another important feature of this hair follicle right here. We say that it's a reservoir for epidermal cells. All right, and that's going to be really important. So let's talk about burns for just a second. Okay, there are three main kinds of burns. Anybody know what the classification for burns are? Yeah, first, second, third degree burns, right? First degree is the most mild form, right, where you might damage the stratum corneum right here, and then you might cause some kind of inflammation down near the stratum basale and maybe in this papillary region right here. These cells don't get damaged, but they get inflamed. Certainly they're not dead. And so blood rushes into this area through these subpapillary plexes right here, so you get a little swelling and redness because you get more blood going to this area. But that's not such a big deal, right? Because if you damage these stratum corneum cells, who cares, right? Because what are they anyway? They're dead, right? And so they're going to be replaced because the stratum basale right here is not damaged, and so it's going to continue proliferating or growing and replace those cells. Of course, all these hair shafts, right, you might burn those off. But again, that's not such a big deal because they're growing from deep in the dermis right here. Although it is painful because you damage these nerve endings. All right, what about a second degree burn? A little bit more painful, a little bit deeper. It involves more tissue. All right, and maybe these capillaries right here are damaged somewhat, so they become leaky. They're going to leak plasma into these spaces right here, forming what on the surface of the skin? A blister, okay? And it's a little bit more painful, but again, it's not really too bad because the cells in the stratum basale right here are not damaged, right? And so they can repair this area of the integument no problem because they're still alive, right? Okay, so that's a second degree burn. And so first and second degree burns aren't too dangerous because the epidermis isn't damaged to the point to where it starts to leak fluid. If your body starts to leak fluid, what are you going to be really concerned with? Dehydration. And that can hurt people. That can kill people. And the other, what's another good reason why you want to have a nice continuous barrier on your body? Prevent infection. Right, so first and second degree burns really aren't too bad because you don't have to worry too much about infection as long as you don't bust those blisters, right? And you don't have to worry too much about dehydration. Now, third degree burn, pretty serious condition because now these cells in the epidermis have been destroyed, right? And they've been maybe even turned to charcoal, for instance. That's a really kind of a terrible circumstance. Let's just say down to the level of where I have the cursor right here. All those cells superficial to where my cursor is moving, right, are now turned to charcoal. Now you can imagine that's a very serious condition because a patient is going to be very susceptible to dehydration and infection, and that could kill them in a matter of hours, right? So is this patient lucky or unlucky? Okay, in my way of thinking, this patient is still really lucky. And you might wonder, well, why is that? All right, well, let's trace the stratum basale. Where is it going? Up and down over here, all these cells are gone, gets to a hair follicle, and look what we have down over here. We have a nice functional stratum basale that is what? Lining the hair follicle that's deep down in the dermis. This layer has not been damaged in the scenario that I proposed to you. So I say this person is lucky because these stratum basale cells can proliferate and repopulate the skin right in this area right here. So I think this person is pretty lucky because they can still grow their skin back as long as you do what? Make sure they don't die of dehydration and infection. Okay. Now let's think of another case, another third degree burn where somebody burns their skin all the way down to the hypodermis. Now why do I think that person is really unlucky? The stratum basale is totally wiped out in that part of their body. So now what do they need? You got to worry, of course, about dehydration and infection, but what else do you have to be concerned with? How's that skin going to grow back? There's no stratum basale there anymore, so in that particular case, then they need a graft, and hopefully, you know, a nice autograft from some other part of their body, and that graft then has to be placed on this burn, and then the skin will grow back. All right, so that's why it's really important to know these layers. So how you treat and care for patients, really, and how you stage disease and understand pathology is related to the kinds of layers that are involved with some kind of disease process or traumatic event, right? So please be aware of all your layers. So I tell you what, real fast, let's just say the layers of the epidermis in thick skin, really fast, starting with the deepest. What do you got? Stratum basale, spinosum, granulosum, lucidum, and corneum, right? Okay, so you guys are right when you're saying stratum. That's probably pretty important. All right, so this is a pretty good illustration to appreciate and label all the parts. I'm sure it is an exam figure. And I probably have even a little video on this someplace, either on my website or in Blackboard, where you can kind of listen to this discussion that we've had. Okay. The other interesting thing that that I'll talk about in passing, see these dermal papillae right here? They are extensuated and kind of magnified in thick skin. And these are the things that actually, as they move up to the surface of the skin, produce fingerprints and toe prints. Right? So dermal papillae you can actually observe on the surface of your body. Okay, not just one, but you might have a group of them forming a fingerprint on the surface of the body. All right, so that's pretty good for the dermis, the reticular layer. Okay, we talked a little bit about skin color already. Any kind of chemical that absorbs light is what we call a pigment. And if you have a pigment that in white light, right, which is coming from the sun, if it goes through a raindrop or through a prism, what do you get? You get that white light broken down into all its component wavelengths, all its component colors. So white light has what, red, orange, yellow, blue, indigo, violet. Okay, you don't have to memorize the spectrum, but white light has all those different colors in there, and a pigment will absorb certain colors and reflect others. So if you have a yellow pigment, that pigment is absorbing everything except yellow, and it's reflecting that yellow wavelength back to your eye, and so it looks yellow to you. Okay? If you have a pigment that's absorbing all the wavelengths of sunlight, right, then nothing really is reflected back to your eye, and so it kind of looks, what, really dark, because you don't have much color content to it. All right, and most of us, everybody in this class anyway, has some pigments in our skin that absorb sunlight, all right, because sunlight can be very damaging to the skin. And those, there are cells in the stratum basale that produce this pigment. Does anybody know what the name of those cells are that produce a pigment that protect their skin? Melanocytes, and the pigment is called melanin in particular, right? All right, so skin color is based on the amount and kinds of melanin that are produced in our skin. And also, since we have a lot of blood in our skin, right, that will also give skin a kind of color. If it's nice, healthy, oxygenated blood, that will give our skin kind of a pinkish look. And if it's deoxygenated blood, maybe you're having heart problems or lung problems or something like that, then blood is not going to be red, it's going to be more blue. And it's going to color your skin kind of blue. So let's talk about these different kinds of things. All right, so you got melanocytes producing melanin in the stratum basale. Moles and age spots are an increased number of melanocytes as we get older. Right, some melanocytes proliferate and produce these little spots on our body. Freckles are increased melanin production in just one little small area in our body. And albinism, did we talk about albinism? I think maybe we did. That's an abnormal condition where somebody, all right, and it's inherited and congenital. You're born with this particular condition where your cells, your melanocytes, can't produce melanin. All right, so you're totally void of any kind of color. So you're going to have totally white skin or pink skin. Your hair will be completely white. And the downside to that is what? You're really susceptible to sunlight. You can get burned by going out in strong sun in probably just, you know, a minute, maybe even 30 seconds or 45 seconds, your skin can be damaged. Okay. Cyanosis is due to, instead of oxygenated blood, deoxygenated blood giving skin kind of a bluish cast to it, right? All right, so cyanosis is certainly skin color when somebody's first born. Babies, infants, right after birth are gauged as to what the color of their skin is, and if they're bluish, right, then that could mean a number of things. It could maybe mean some kind of heart defect, or lungs aren't formed properly. It could mean respiratory distress or cardiovascular disease. Okay, and in every case, it has to be diagnosed very quickly, or you could lose that person. All right, so cyanosis is blue. What about jaundice? What color is jaundice?
Yellow.
Okay, and again, when we look at a newborn baby, we're not only concerned with a nice pink color skin or if it's blue, but we're also interested to see if they have a yellow cast to them, because that could be due to a blood disease, right? Or it could be due to maybe a liver problem, okay, if they have a yellow cast to them. And adults can be jaundiced, right, if they have liver problems, because there's a compound that comes from the blood called bilirubin. If it isn't being processed properly, then they'll have a yellow cast to them. And so sometimes patients undergoing chemotherapy that's really rough on their liver might become jaundiced, and that's just a side effect of that particular chemotherapy. Okay, and birthmarks, we probably all have birthmarks. That's deep down in the dermis. That's a localized increase in blood vessels or vascularity in some part of your skin. Okay, and that's going to be a birthmark. Those typically don't change too much. All right, there's a couple other conditions that are sort of interesting, like vitiligo. What does vitiligo produce on people? Okay, it changes the color of your skin, usually in just a small area, okay? And it produces like an albinism condition in that one area. So somebody will have all their normal body color that they inherited from their parents, except in one spot, it will be completely white. All right, so what's your concern about that spot? Well, it might spread. Yeah, you might be concerned about that, but more immediately. Sunburn. Absolutely right, right? So if you have a white spot on your forehead and you go outside, that spot can be sunburned very, very easily. All right, and that is due to an autoimmune disease where a person's own immune system mistakes the melanocytes in that part of your body as being foreign, and they're attacked and destroyed, so they don't produce melanin. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. A good way to decrease that response is the use of steroids, for instance. All right. Okay, but as somebody mentioned, that could be a progressive disease, and I think maybe steroids do inhibit the progression of that disease. Okay, but I'm not really so sure. We don't have very good ways of treating autoimmune diseases yet, like different kinds of arthritis, maybe multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease, other kinds of diseases. All right, hair structures on the skin. The shaft lies above the surface of the skin. The root and bulb are below the surface, right? And that hair follicle is a deep invagination of the epidermis, and we just saw how important that is for understanding burns and treating burns, because that invagination acts as a reservoir of epidermal cells that are deep down inside the dermis. If somebody has red color hair, oh, I should have mentioned that up over here. If somebody has red color hair, right, then that's just a function of melanin that those melanocytes are producing. And those melanocytes are also incorporating a little bit of an iron molecule, right? That same kind of iron molecule that gives your blood a red color, if it's being incorporated into melanin, it will give that little area in your body kind of a reddish color as well, okay? Not due to blood, but just due to the iron molecule itself. All right, what about that muscle? We talked about that muscle, that's the arrector pili. Watch the spelling of that in case you get that in a lab exam or something. Okay. And we talked about these glands already. Good. A couple other kinds of glands we didn't talk about. Okay. So the glands you can break down into sebaceous glands versus sweat glands. We talked about eccrine sweat glands and apocrine sweat glands. There are a couple other sweat glands, like mammary glands, are modified sweat glands. And they're modified because they don't secrete sweat, but they secrete a milk product under proper endocrine control. Okay, and we usually have two, but actually more, all of us have really more than two, all right, but only two have developed to the point to where you can actually see them with your naked eye. Okay, the others are just auxiliary mammary glands. And a ceruminous gland secretes a compound called cerumen. This is in your external ear canal. Where's that? You could point, but don't plug up your ears because then you won't hear me lecturing. Okay, and as a matter of fact, if you have too much cerumen in your ear, you won't be able to hear lecture either. All right, and cerumen is kind of an oily but also a waxy compound. It's a hydrocarbon, very long chain. All right, and that's used to lubricate your eardrum. And that's important for hearing because in order for sound, okay, to be produced or to be heard, there has to be a membrane that vibrates back and forth, right? So your eardrum has to vibrate back and forth in order for you to hear. So that's got to be a very pliable membrane because if it ever gets really dried out, like maybe the surface of your skin dries out sometimes and it starts to move, it's going to crack. Okay, so I don't think that ever happens because in people you have that cerumen in there. But if these glands are so active that you have a buildup of wax inside the ear, then of course you won't be able to hear very much, and that wax probably should be cleaned out. And I don't know why some people have a more active ceruminous gland compared to others. Some people actually have to go see somebody to get that ear wax removed. Right? And there are different solutions that are used, but it is important that when you put a solution in your external auditory canal, that it is body temperature, or maybe a little warm. Because if it's cold, like if you just squirt some cold water in there to wash that wax out, that's going to produce immediately by reflex projectile vomiting. Okay, so it's important to make sure that that is warmed up to body temperature. Okay. All right, so projectile vomiting is what? Very violent, all right, kind of response. Nails. I think you do have an exam figure on nails, so let's see about if I can find some nails to talk about. Oh, look at that nice sebaceous gland. Okay. Here's a nail. Okay, so here you can see the fingertip. Here you can see the body of the nail. Okay, and the body of the nail grows out from inside your finger, grows out from underneath the proximal nail fold, all right, and then the root of the nail is underneath this tissue right here, but these cells are already dead. They're filled with a chemical that you're familiar with. What kind of chemical do you think is in these? These are keratinocytes, right, and they're filled with keratin, okay? And so these are just epidermal cells that are loaded with keratin. Would you say more or less that's in the stratum corneum that we see up over here? More keratin or less keratin? Probably more because the nail is a lot harder, right? So nails help protect the ends of your digits, and of course they can be used for self-defense, right, and catching prey and all that kinds of stuff. Some of that is kind of hard to relate to when we're living in Los Angeles, okay, but we certainly have an evolutionary history of that. But where the nail grows from is the nail matrix. All right, so don't think that the nail grows from the root. Okay, it grows from the matrix. So that could be a really good trick question, maybe on an exam. All right, so the question would be, where does the nail grow from? And we could say the free edge, the nail bed, the body, the root, or the matrix. And you're going to say the matrix. Okay, now here is a circumstance, another circumstance where one word can mean a number of different things, right? So matrix, what does matrix mean to you? Really cool movie. Okay, what else? It could mean the extracellular space in a connective tissue, but in this particular location, the matrix means what? That's the active region that's actually producing those keratinocytes that will become your nail as it grows out of your body. Okay. All right, so this is a highly vascular region right here, and so it actually gives this part of the nail a little bit different color, like, and you can see the lanula right here, and this little flap of skin is called the eponychium, okay, that is just kind of growing out along with the nail body. And here you see the free edge of the nail, right? The free edge of the nail. So make sure that you can label this, but don't get the root and matrix confused. All right, and I don't know if this is an exam figure or not. Okay. All right, what else? Oh, don't forget about your functions of the integumentary system. Okay, protection, got another important thing. Items referring to protection prevents water loss, keeps infectious particles out, melanin absorbs harmful radiation from the sun, right? Hair is a heat insulator, but also it's an important sensory structure, right? For things brushing up against your body, in particular your eyes. You have hair that keeps foreign bodies out of your nose and eyes, as well as your ears. And the nails, of course, are important because it protects the tips of your fingers and toes. And what do we call those things? Fingers and toes are digits, right? Okay. It's also important because of temperature regulation. Vasodilation of dermal blood vessels allow you to radiate heat from your body. Vasoconstriction of dermal blood vessels keep body temperature, keeps you warm, right? It diverts blood to your core that keeps you alive. All right, so when your core temperature is above 98.6, are your dermal blood vessels vasoconstricted or vasodilated? When it's above 98.6, this is a test to see if you know vasodilation or constriction. And you're saying vasodilated because it's taking heat from your body and radiating it out into the room, or maybe when you're sweating, then it will use that energy to cool your body down. Okay. Sunlight is used to make an inactive form of vitamin D, which then can be converted into an active form by the liver. All right, so you need some sunlight for that to happen, and then of course vitamin D is necessary for calcium and phosphate absorption in your diet. And you can't make calcium or phosphate, you have to have that in your diet. And you need to have a vitamin D precursor in your diet as well, so that you can absorb these compounds. And then of course another important function is communication with your environment, sensation. And then lastly, age-related effects on the skin. Okay, so your skin changes all the time, right, as we get older. And most of the age-related effects on the skin are due to changes in blood vessels in the skin, because you need oxygen and nutrients to maintain the health of the skin. And sunlight damages those blood vessels, right? So it's good to stay out of the sun, okay? Unless you have a lot of melanin, that gives you a little breathing room in terms of sunlight, right? That helps protect your skin, keeps it nice and young. All right, so as we get older, skin becomes thinner and more transparent. Why is that? Because we lose blood supply. We lose blood supply to the skin, okay? There's a decreased collagen in the dermis, which means that the dermis is more easily damaged. If you brush up against something sharp, your skin is more easily damaged and repairs more slowly. Okay, so why does your skin produce less collagen as you get older? Decreased blood supply to the skin. So those fibroblasts, right, just can't be as active. And once your skin is damaged, you don't have the same oxygen and nutrients, so it takes longer to repair compared to when you're in high school. All right. And because you have decreased blood flow, you have decreased elastic fibers and decreased lipids, right? That causes the skin to sag and to wrinkle because you're losing these nice elastic fibers. And these sweat glands and sebaceous glands need blood to do their job, and then when that goes away, you have decreased activity of sweat glands. And so what does that do? Have you ever heard when there was like a heat wave in Los Angeles? What do they tell people to do, especially a certain group of people? The elderly, stay indoors, don't go outside, right? Don't paint the house or mow the lawn, because your sweat glands just can't produce as much sweat. You have a tendency to overheat as a result of that. Right? You have poor temperature regulation as you get older. And not too many years ago, France had a heat wave in the summertime. It was like in August, beginning of August, maybe end of July. And what's a really nice thing about living in Europe? in the summertime. Everybody goes on vacation, right? Hardly anybody works, unless you run a restaurant or something, right? That's really, really nice. And it just so happened that during this time, everybody was on vacation, all right? But where's Grandma and Grandpa? They're stuck at home, okay? And this heat wave hit, and about 8,000 people died, all elderly. It was just phenomenal. It just blew me away because there's nobody in the hospitals. Everybody was down on the med vacationing, okay? And the temperature went up into the hundreds, and it's usually really nice temperate conditions. Nobody had air conditioners, and it really killed a lot of elderly people, right? So really be aware of that when you're thinking of your grandma and grandpa, okay? If it gets really, really hot, right, be nice to them when it's hot out. And if you're on vacation and there's a heat wave, call them and see how they're doing, right? Because it'd be terrible to come home from a nice vacation and they croak because they got overheated. All right. I should actually find, there probably is a newspaper article someplace about that. It was just amazing. Okay, your skin color changes. That might be due to an increase or decreased number of melanocytes, depending on where they are to those capillaries that are surviving, right? And what else happens? Our hair, it changes color. How does it change usually? Yeah, to white or gray, because there are blood vessels. Oh, let me see if I can find a hair follicle. Ooh, not like that. A hair follicle. Right, has blood vessels. You can see some blood vessels up in here, and that supports the stratum basale in this part of the hair, which causes the hair to grow. And as we get older, this blood supply is decreased, and so these melanocytes, right, have a tendency to die out. And so as this hair is produced, it no longer has hair color. It becomes silver or gray as a result. All right, so any kind of age-related change on the skin, you should think of due to what's the primary reason? Yeah, blood supply to the skin, right? So your skin dries out, it's not oily anymore, so it cracks, okay? All due to those blood vessels in your skin. So if you want to protect your skin, what's the best thing you can do? You can buy $500 lotions to put on your skin. Is that going to do anything? Probably not, because it's not going to affect the blood vessels, right? So probably diet and exercise is really important. But one thing that you can do, because we don't diet and exercise very much, is what? Stay out of the sun, right? Or if you're in the sun, then you can put on lotions that act as sunscreen to protect your skin, right? Okay. There's something that I find a little bit interesting, right? As we get older, our hair turns white, okay? No matter who you are, right? If your ethnicity is from Africa or Indonesia or whatever, our hairs are going to turn white. But how come our skin doesn't turn white as we get older? Does anybody notice that? Anybody notice their grandma and grandpa turning white? Their hair turns white, but how come not their skin? I find that kind of interesting. Because the capillaries that are most sensitive are these right here in the hair follicle. Not so much those that are in the dermal papillae. Right? So these still work pretty well. Right, maintaining those melanocytes in our skin, but not these melanocytes down here in the hair follicles. Okay, so that just kind of reemphasizes the importance of blood vessels maintaining the skin. All right, who's got any questions on integument? And you know what? This is noteworthy right now. Why are we at a noteworthy pause? Because we've covered all the material on the first test. Is that right? Did I get that right? Chapters 1, 2, 4, and 5. Yeah. All right, so anything forward in lecture today is not going to be on the first test. It's going to be on test number 2. All right, so I think you guys are in pretty good shape for that first test, as long as you're spending some time at home doing stuff. All right, let's see. Do I have any comments about the online activities? Maybe, but I'll take a question first. Yeah. Yeah. You know what? It's going to be photocopies of figures, and so you're going to label things. I don't think I pick on tissues too much because we do a really good job in lab on tissues. So there probably will be more word questions on tissues. Yeah. Like what's something to think about in terms of a connective tissue? Why is it different than an epithelium? Okay, and maybe something about the cell types in an epithelium, but it would be a word kind of question. Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, and you have to have precursors in your diet for vitamin D. Okay, those precursors get changed to another precursor. And when I say precursor, it means that it won't have an active value in your body. All right, so in your skin, that precursor vitamin D molecule has to be modified. And then that modified precursor goes to the liver, and then the liver then can do the final stage of activating it. Yeah, it gives you the most potent form of vitamin D. But you need to have the precursors in your diet, and you need sunlight before the liver can actually make that active form for you. Okay? It's not so important that you know the names of all these precursors. Okay? You should just know that you got to have precursors in your diet, you got to have some sunlight, and then you have to have a good functioning liver in order for you to absorb calcium and phosphate. All right? Unless you take a lot of vitamin pills. If you take a lot of active vitamin D, okay, then you probably don't need so much sunlight. Okay. Okay, and yeah, another question. Yes, you need a Scantron. I don't have one on me. Let's see. I think I have it right in the syllabus. It's an 8-8. Yeah, hold one up. Oh, what color is that?
Green.
882E. Yeah, there's an 882ES. I don't like those. Okay, there's an 882 Lovas. That one I really don't like because the bubbles that you fill in have a background color on them, and sometimes that confuses the Scantron reader. So get the kind that are completely clear inside the bubble. And get the ones that have a capital A, capital B all the way across. Some of the others have a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but my answers aren't 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They're what? Capital A, capital B, capital C, capital D. So then you don't have to convert from letters to numbers. All right? So that's the easiest way of doing that. 882E is really, really good. And it's the green thing? The green one?
With the brackets.
With the brackets. Okay. Good. And don't forget, that's a week from Wednesday. You got to have that. Plus, what else do you need a week from Wednesday besides a pencil and an eraser and a Scantron? Picture ID. You need your Cypress College picture ID. Okay, yeah. Format is multiple choice, word questions. Could be matching. So there might be a bunch of, maybe muscle. And over here will be some characteristics of the three kinds of muscle. So you might say voluntary. Well, then you got to match that answer with what muscle is voluntary. So matching, multiple choice, maybe true/false. I'm not so big on true/false because sometimes they're just really hard and tricky, or they're too easy. You know, so I can't find some that are right in between. Matching terminology to a figure that's in your textbook that I photocopy. So you have to label those lead lines. And probably not on this test. I won't have you write in. Not like you have on the lab practicum. Okay. So you'll have what some students call kind of like a word bank. You'll have all the answers. You just have to match it up or choose the correct answers. Right? Yeah. Any other questions about the exam? No? Okay. Now, what's real important with the exam coming up, unlike the online quizzes, okay, it is closed book and no notes, right? No cell phones, no nothing, just the information that you have in your head. So, because the online quizzes, you can use materials, but this is another step beyond that, right? So, I just want people, don't be shocked if you come in and somebody says, oh, you got to put your books away. You're going to say, oh, I knew that, right? Can't use your books or notes during the test. The other important thing is that I think on the study guides, I put the figures in black and white. Okay, because guess what your test is going to be? Living color or black and white?
Black and white.
So don't memorize the names of structures on diagrams by the colors that you see in your book. All right, because that won't work. Understand the structures by their shape and by relationship to other structures, not just by the artificial colors that were used in the book, right? Because it's going to be a grayscale on the test. Yeah? Question? No? Okay. All right, so let's move on to another chapter. So I can close the skin out right here. All right, so you're probably getting a feel for the pace of the class. And I know it seems like a lot, but hopefully you're getting the feeling like maybe if you apply yourself, you can actually learn it pretty easily, maybe have a little fun with the class. All right. And the way to approach the class is do the pre-lecture reading assignment first, before lecture. That helps you a lot, I'm sure. Okay. All right, so I'm going to put integument away. And we're going to start talking about the skeletal system. That's chapter 6. And let me put this away too. Okay. So this is an introductory chapter to bones. And immediately you should think, what kind of tissue is bone? It's connective tissue, right? So the cells are separated by extensive matrix, because it's a connective tissue, right? And here are the kinds of connective tissues that make up the skeletal system. We have cartilage. Is that a connective tissue? Absolutely. Bone, is that a connective tissue? Yeah. And what about ligaments? All right, is that a connective tissue? Or is that an epithelium? Or is it muscle? It's a connective tissue. Good. Now here we're going to start kind of expanding on our knowledge of connective tissues a little bit. Okay. Now what kind of connective tissue is a ligament? You didn't have to know this for lab, but maybe for this lecture test you might have to know something about a ligament. What kind of connective tissue is it? Okay. It's not cartilage. It's a dense, regular connective tissue. So it's made up of collagen in the matrix, and the collagen is all oriented in parallel sheets, so it's really strong, so you can't stretch it out. Right? But if you pull it from side to side, you can rip it. Right, but not from end to end because it's too strong. All right, so those are the components and the functions of the skeletal system. Support, all right? Bones are really rigid and strong, can support great weight, right? And cartilage, on the other hand, is a lot lighter. That's an advantage. It takes less muscle to haul cartilage around. All right, it's kind of firm, it has a structure to it, and it's flexible, so if you want a part of your body that is a little bit bendy, all right, but yet still holds some structure, cartilage is a perfect connective tissue to use, like your ear or your nose, for instance. And if all of the cartilage in your body that made up your ears, for instance, and your nose and other cartilages that you have in your body, if it was made out of bone, you'd have to eat a lot more. You'd have to be a lot stronger to haul all that extra weight around because bone is very, very heavy. Right? So it's not an advantage to have all that extra weight. Cartilage also is used as a model during development. Sometimes a bone grows out of cartilage, right? And that will determine where the bone will eventually be. Then that cartilage model is filled in with osteoblasts and it's turned into bone in a process called ossification. Okay, so sometimes cartilage is used for that as well. All right, another important function of bone, since it's hard, it's like armor plating. All right, so you have the bones of the skull that protect your brain. You have the vertebral column that protects your spinal cord, your nervous system, right? That's very, very soft tissue. And the rib cage, your ribs protect, yeah, your lungs and your heart, right? Both of those. Wouldn't want to do without either of those, right? Vertebral column protects the spinal cord. All right, bones are also important for movement because muscles can attach to bones via another kind of dense, regular connective tissue that we call a tendon. All right, so a bone-to-muscle connection is called a tendon, but a bone-to-bone connection is called a ligament. So it's the exact same kind of tissue, but it just connects two different things together. So ligaments, right, prevent or limit the motion of bones. Like what kind of bones? Anybody know a name of a couple bones where there is not a lot of motion between? Okay, so tummy, two bones. And between those two bones, there should not be a lot of motion. Some of you have studied bones in lab already. Those that haven't had a bone lab, they won't have the slightest idea how to answer this question. So, like the frontal, somebody said frontal bone and a parietal bone, bones of the head. Okay? They're held together by ligaments, because only in science fiction movies, like if you're from Mars, does your head kind of move around, right? Okay, but in most people, your head isn't moving around because there are ligaments between those bones. Oh, there's also a ligament between your teeth, okay, and your mandible, or your teeth and your maxilla that hold your teeth in position, right? So those ligaments prevent motion. Okay. On the other hand, a tendon attaches to a muscle, to a bone, so when that muscle contracts, it pulls on the bone and it makes the bone move, right, on the other end of the scale. Okay. And storage. This is probably, this is a huge important function. Right? It's a storage area for calcium and for phosphate. Sometimes we say inorganic phosphate. Inorganic phosphate is a little bit complicated molecule. It has some oxygen atoms on it. Right? It's a little bit bigger. Calcium is just an atom all by itself. So these things are stored in bone. These things give bone its strength, but it also acts as a reservoir. So right now, if I were to ask you, what is the importance of calcium in your body? What would you say? What's calcium important for? Okay. What's calcium important for? Everybody said some good things at once and I didn't hear anything. Okay. Calcium is important because you need calcium to make strong bones. Okay. This is true. But you're going to find out in this class that calcium is important, actually more important for other reasons. And when you run out of calcium in your blood, guess where your body goes to get calcium so these other more important functions don't suffer? It goes to bones, right, to get calcium. Okay, same thing for phosphate. And bones also store fat. What good is fat? Energy molecule. It's an energy molecule, right? So you need energy so that you can do work. And bones store fat in yellow bone marrow. We're going to find out where that is. All right, so storage is really important. All right, here's another reason bones are important, because it can make red blood cells. It can keep you from becoming anemic. The production of red blood cells is what we call hemopoiesis. So bones are a hemopoietic tissue that build red blood cells and platelets. How many red blood cells does your body have to make every second? I think we talked about this. About 2 million, okay? Because they don't live for a very long period of time. Oh, maybe it was in lab I talked about it, okay? You lose about 2 million red blood cells every second, and you would become anemic unless your hemopoietic tissue can build 2 million every second, all right? So you're not only busy taking anatomy notes right now, you're busy making red blood cells, right? Millions every second. All right, so let's see. Let's take a look at a figure right here. All right, so here you can see a skeleton. All right, so you see the bones and kind of like this yellow right here. And the blue, all right, represents cartilage, as well as, what do we got, orange and red? Something like that. Okay, so the blue is a hyaline cartilage. You can see it making up the nose, cartilage of the rib cage, right, and also covering the ends of bones, parts of articulations, parts of joints are hyaline cartilage. All right, we have some fibrocartilages, like the meniscus of our knee and the pubic symphysis right here. The meniscus stabilizes the knee joint. This joint right here is a pretty tough joint. It doesn't move very much except during childbirth. Or if you're riding a motorcycle and you get into an accident and you go through the handlebars, okay, that joint is going to separate. But the good thing is, what can you tell me about that joint? It kind of goes back the way it was, okay, mostly. Not 100%, but mostly does. Okay, and you can see some fibrocartilage in the intervertebral discs as well. Ah, here's another important part for hyaline cartilage. It helps make up the windpipe, namely the trachea and the upper parts of the airway called the larynx. Okay, so that gives these structures some shape so that they cannot collapse. All right, so that's where we find cartilage. All right, and here are the three kinds. I think you're familiar with all these already. The glassy-like one that's just a little translucent, that's hyaline cartilage. The cells are always chondrocytes that secrete into the matrix. Chondrocytes you find in lacunae, and you probably have a nice idea of what it looks like, right? Then elastic cartilage, oh, I forgot to mention that. Elastic cartilage of the ear, okay? Fibrocartilage, I showed you where that can be found in the skeleton. All right, so let's classify bones and maybe some parts of bones. We can classify bones by their shape. And here's a pretty good figure. Okay, if there's a bone that is in one dimension is very large, but in the two other dimensions is relatively short, right? So this is a large bone in terms of the superior inferior direction, but anterior, posterior, and right and left is not very big. So this is what we call a long bone. All right, so it's big only in one dimension. And a good example is the humerus. But long bones are also found in the digits. All right, so let me zoom into this region right here. Okay, can you see that this here, even though it's a very small bone, meaning that it's short, it's still a long bone because it's big in one dimension and small in the other two, right? And these are what we call phalanges. These are phalanges down over here that make up your digits. Oops. Okay. Another kind of bone is a short bone, like the bones that make up the wrist, right? These are sometimes what we call carpals. These are short bones. They're short in any direction that you look at them. Flat bones can be big in two dimensions, but small in one dimension, making it look kind of flat, like the sternum right here is a flat bone. And then you got some really weird shaped bones, like a vertebrae. We call that irregular. All right, so these are just different ways with some examples on how we can classify bones. Flat, I knew I was forgetting one. Your book forgets one. Here's a special kind of bone right here. This is your kneecap. And the kneecap, otherwise it's known as the patella, this is a sesamoid bone. And a sesamoid bone is kind of special because it is completely surrounded by a tendon. So anytime you have a bone develop inside a tendon, we call it a sesamoid bone. And your kneecaps, of course, are absolutely normal. There's one in your thumb that's really, really small. Sesamoid bones can develop and other tendons in the body, but that's usually due to inflammation, some kind of inflammatory process, and that's really not a normal, healthy condition. Okay. Okay. All right. So here is something really important for lab as well as lecture. We use a long bone to talk about some typical properties of bones. All right. So we really analyze a typical long bone right over here. Know its parts. All right, so here, would you all agree that this is a long bone right here? Yeah, and in particular, this is the humerus that we find in your arm. Okay, the ends of a long bone are what we call the epiphyses. So here is an epiphysis, and down over here we have an epiphysis. The epiphysis that is closest to some center location in your body is what we call the proximal epiphysis. The one that's farther away is called the distal epiphysis. All right, and then you have the bone that connects the epiphyses, and that's what we call the diaphysis. Another name for diaphysis would be the shaft of a long bone. All right, so the shaft of a long bone and epiphysis are the same thing. Okay, the ends of the epiphyses, if it's going to make a joint that's movable, are covered with hyaline cartilage. All right, so sometimes we call that articular cartilage or joint cartilage. That's just hyaline cartilage that's covering the tips of the epiphyses. All right, and then we got a couple membranes. There's a membrane that surrounds, completely surrounds the exterior surface of a bone, and we call that the periosteum. Peri means surrounding. Osteum means the membrane surrounding the bone. All right. Notice that we have a lot of spaces inside this bone. We're going to talk about those spaces. But these spaces have a membrane that covers them. It doesn't have the periosteum, but it sounds similar. It actually has the endosteum. I don't see it on this. Oh, yeah, here. All right, so here we have the endosteum. End meaning inside the bone. And it has different kinds of cellular makeup compared to the periosteum that we're going to look at in just a little bit. All right, let me tell you a couple last things about this bone right here. If we look at the superficial bone, all right, like right in here, notice how solid looking that bone is. All right, it's very solid bone. We sometimes call that compact bone. And where do you find it? Near the surface of the bone. And remember, organs can be thought of as having a superficial region and then a deep region. The superficial region is what we call the cortex of that organ. The deeper regions are what we call the medulla. All right, so since this is a superficial region, sometimes we call this cortical bone because it's out by the surface. The deeper bone right here, notice it has a different shape. Here's a zoomed in region of it. It looks spongy, so we call that spongy bone. But we never find spongy bone on the cortex. We find it deep. What do we call the deep part of an organ? The medulla, right? So medullary bone is spongy bone, a different kind of bone. The advantage is that it's a lot lighter. It's almost as strong, but it's certainly a lot lighter. And your body puts things in these spaces, like either fat or hematopoietic tissue for making red blood cells, right? So medullary bone. And that's where we come up with this big, the name for this big cavity that's inside the diaphysis of a bone. So we call that the medullary cavity. And this medullary cavity contains yellow bone marrow. You can see it kind of look yellow right there. So that's just a storage form of energy. All right, so I would say look over this figure for next time. We'll start here next time and learn some more histology. Oh, where's the sign-in sheet at? The sign-in sheet going around? Everybody sign it, please.